They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A chat with Gallup about jobs and what voters want along those lines. Facebook needs more friends, if you can believe that. And what we didn't know about Fukushima. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 8th of March. Good to have you here today. Tomorrow is Friday, which will bring with it the much-anticipated February unemployment report. One could guess about what the number will be, but much safer to wait. And while we do that, there was some news today on jobs, actually, and the prospect for more of them. This afternoon, the House, by a wide bipartisan majority, passed a couple of bills designed to make it easier for small businesses and startups to hire new people. Stands to reason jobs and getting more of them in this economy are a good thing, but what do Americans really think?
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. The weekly segment he joins us for is called Attitude Check. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So we were in Atlanta on Monday, and we talked to a bunch of college kids about the economy and jobs and how worried they are. And at one point, I asked them what the government ought to be doing to create jobs. Should the government be creating jobs? And this kid, he's like 21, 22. He graduates in 4 months. And he said, yeah, the government should do something, but maybe not everything. What's the wider data tell us on that?
Well, that's very interesting. There's broad agreement of American public opinion that the government should do something which leads to the creation of more jobs. That's our number one problem.
Right.
It's the number one thing people say they're going to take into account in voting on the president and so forth. So there's a broad agreement. But the devil is in the details.
Always
is. Like your college student said. Absolutely. You know, creating jobs can go all the way from like Franklin Roosevelt to very indirect kind of tax incentives and so forth. And we find, generally speaking, that Americans in our data say indirectly they like the idea of the government creating jobs.
So when you say direct government provision of jobs, that's like the government making the jobs themselves, yes?
That's right. We had about 17% of Americans when we said, what's the best way to create more jobs in the U.S., who said something very direct, like infrastructure work, spend actual government money building a new bridge, and that creates jobs, or more stimulus money. That's what we call very direct government involvement, and that's to be differentiated from things like changing the task structure or reducing government regulations, things along those lines.
Yeah. Do they want national-level efforts on this, or do they want state and local governments to do their bit?
Key question. Americans love anything that is small and local. And we actually found that we ask a very interesting question. How much confidence do you have in each of the following? And we read a list in terms of their advice or their opinions on how to create jobs. And at the very top of the list, small business owners, believe it or not, top of the list, followed by local business leaders, and then state governors, and then mayors and other local officials, all local. And then finally, you get to President Obama. But then below that are executives of big corporations and leaders in Congress.
Do they care what kind of jobs they are? I mean, of course, they want, interesting high-wage jobs. But does it matter if it's in manufacturing or clean tech or IT or what?
Good question. We've not really parsed it to that level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm sure every American has a different idea about what the ideal job that he or she would want to have is. But generally speaking, the broader term is Americans just want a job.
Yeah, riddle me this, though, Frank. Can we presume from this data that people think the government is not doing enough to create jobs?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I would say yes. We actually come at it a different way. And the American public says we have a big problem here and we want the government to do something about it. So I think the indirect inference is yes. Americans would say at this point, government's not doing enough to create jobs.
Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief of Gallup. The segment we do with them about their polling data every week is called Attitude Check. There's more of it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
Talk to you soon.
Don't know yet how the week's going to turn out, but today was pretty good on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. An interesting thing happened on the way to the Facebook IPO today. The company decided it needs a little more help to sell more than $5 billion worth of itself when it goes public. I know, you figure, how hard can it be? I mean, the whole world wants shares of Facebook. They just need somebody to stand by the cash register and take the money, right? Well, no. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has that story.
Facebook updated the status of its IPO. It's in a relationship with 25 more banks. That's a lot of new friends. Facebook shares are highly sought after, and now a total of 31 banks are out peddling the stock to investors. When the banks are on Facebook's friends list, they get the inside track.
They have the opportunity to get more shares than would normally be available to anyone who just knocked on a door and said, "Can I get some shares?"
The whole group of banks will sell shares of Facebook to stockbrokers, pension funds, mutual funds, to every kind of investor across the globe. It's like the IPO of the people, except not quite.
Facebook is a business based on everybody's equal, everybody has a voice. They want to say, hey, we're trying to do the best we can to get the most distribution, but that's all it is PR.
Adam Bold is the CEO of the mutual fund store, which is part of Wells Fargo.
The reality is that the individual investor has almost no shot of getting shares of Facebook on the IPO.
Meaning before the price spikes on that first day of trading. Bolt says Facebook's 31 banks will predictably give the shares to their top clients, usually the ones with the most money. Banks like to save the best deals for their own friends. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
From the drive-thru window at McDonald's comes this glimpse into the personal finances of recession and what it means for businesses. The burger chain reported February sales this morning. They were up, but not as much as the experts had been guessing. You can blame a still weak economy and people still looking for bargains. So the omnipresent fast food king is going to try to focus our attention on its low prices to get more of us in the door. Because the dollar menu's not enough, it seems. Next month, the extra value menu arrives. Sally Herships explains.
For restaurant lovers, the following news is about as welcome as stale, soggy, cold French fries.
With higher gas prices and lower disposable income, it's becoming increasingly difficult for Americans to dine out.
Darren Tristano is a food industry consultant with Technomic. Sad news for diners, but Tristano says it does solve a minor menu mystery. Normally, we expect menus to be organized by type of dish, like appetizer, entree, and dessert, but not McDonald's new extra value menu. That will include everything from coffee to McNuggets.
So they're trying to focus their menu based more along the lines of price versus types of products.
And remember, McDonald's already has a dollar menu and value meals. Tristano says the restaurant is adding another value-based option because consumers are changing. We used to be embarrassed to use coupons in front of our friends, but he says the recession did away with that.
Customer fixation on the word value right now is important.
RJ Hadavi is a senior restaurant analyst at Morningstar. He says as upscale newcomers like Panera and Chipotle are opening their doors, the fast food industry is declining. If McDonald's wants new customers, it'll have to steal them away from its competitors, which are also discounting. So Hadavi says it's critical that the fast food king lets hungry customers know it's offering low-priced options like McNuggets.
These are also pretty high-margin products, things that typically help drive the bottom line.
The new menu is available beginning March 26th. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Vladimir Putin was much in the news earlier this week. The once and future president of Russia was reelected Sunday. By the Kremlin's count, he won 64% of the vote. By the count of election monitors and opposition parties, it was something a good deal less than that amid widespread voter fraud. By the end of this coming term, Putin will have been at or near the top of Russian government for the better part of 20 years. Masha Gessen has just written a new biography of Vladimir Putin. It's called The Man Without a Face. Masha, welcome to the broadcast.
Good to be here.
I wanted to start with a picture that ran above a commentary you had on the New York Times website. A lot of people have probably seen it. Vladimir Putin crying. And I guess what the prospect of his reelection, right? You didn't quite see it that way.
The joy of his reelection.
Yeah.
It's actually a heartbreaking picture for a lot of Russians because we remember that this is the president who did not cry after the Kursk submarine sank, or 130 people died after the theater siege in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And he cried now because he felt that his battle with the protest movement is over, that he has won. And that's such a relief for him.
We should say you are not an objective observer here. I mean, you are opposed to Mr. Putin and you helped lead some protests.
I have. I should say that I finished my book about Putin, The Man Without a Face, before I started working mm-hmm. on the organizing of the protests. That was just good timing for me.
You know, the straight-ahead question is to ask what the Russian people want out of Vladimir Putin. But let me turn it on its head a little bit and ask it this way. What does Putin want out of Russia?
I think he rules very much by instinct. He doesn't have a long-range plan. He thinks that the Soviet Union was the greatest country ever, and the greatest thing that it produced was the KGB. And he has really done everything he can to make Russia institutionally resemble the KGB. It's a closed system, a very paranoid system, a system that thrives on fear, and a corrupt system. And that's what he's recreated in Russia.
What does that mean then for the average person who certainly in the old Soviet Union and in the early days of the chaos of Russia knew their share of hard times?
Well, Putin has been very lucky economically. He has ridden the oil boom. And certainly there has been a lot of wealth in Russia. But that growth has slowed. And also, after a while, people realized that they want something other than material comfort. And what they want is dignity.
Is the frustration of daily life, then, is it that classic Russian vision of bureaucracy that we in the West know so well, if only by reputation? Or is it corruption or some combination of both?
Those are inextricably linked. The bureaucracy is huge and corrupt, and those are its two distinguishing features. So you can't really take a step without coming in contact with the state, and then the state hits you up for bribes and humiliates you up in the process.
Give me some examples. Like what?
Say you have a restaurant in Moscow. You're forbidden by law from cash transactions. You can't buy supplies for a restaurant for cash. In practice, this is virtually impossible. You know, you can't shop at a farmer's market. So you create a back office that is engaged entirely in falsifying contracts to cover for your cash transactions, which you have to do in order to actually get food for your restaurant.
And so the corruption becomes habit, right?
The corruption becomes habit, and the corruption becomes essential to the existence of any business or the bureaucrats that watch over this business.
Masha Gessen. Her book about Vladimir Putin is called The Man Without a Face. Masha, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, inside the Fukushima meltdown, what we knew and when we knew it.
I will say that the quantity and quality of information that we're getting is less than we're normally accustomed to, and it's been rather frustrating.
But first, let's do the numbers. Magic 8-Ball says outlook good on the deal to restructure Greek debt. And so the Dow Industrials picked up 70 points today, more than 0.5%, 12,907 the number. The NASDAQ rose 34 points, 1.2%, 2970. The S&P 500 tagged on 13 points, just shy of 1%, finished things at 1365. Shares of Wells Fargo galloped up around 3.25%. Investors seem to like the news that Wells is eliminating some free checking accounts in 6 days, one of which actually might be mine. Oh, man. Elsewhere among financials, Citigroup deposited a gain of 2.3%. Morgan Stanley pocketed an increase of 1.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.02%. And you are listening to Market Plays.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. How long were the unemployment lines last month? The Labor Department reports on the employment situation for February. Also in Washington, the Commerce Department issues international trade data for January. And she's got all the clothes and curves, and then there's that dream house. Barbie turns 53. Doesn't look a day over 20-something. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I had a rare treat flying back from Atlanta Monday night. The seat next to me, if you can believe this, was actually empty. I mention that because the Federal Aviation Administration issued its annual air travel forecast today. Grim, continued grim through morning, sums it up pretty well. Crowded planes and expensive tickets as far as the eye can see. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Think you don't have enough elbow room on flights now? Just wait. The FAA says the average plane is now 82% full, and that'll go up to 83%. Fuel prices will also rise to $140 a barrel by 2032. Airline analyst Daryl Jenkins.
In the 1990s, jet fuel was about 15% of your operating costs. Now, it's for a lot of airlines, it's half of your operating costs.
Those higher costs will be passed on to us. You'll have to work harder to get a bargain, according to BestFares.com CEO Tom Parsons.
Just be patient. Keep an open mind. Maybe think 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks out.
Parsons says fares will continue their slow, steady climb. Still, the FAA says more and more people will fly and will reach 1 billion passengers a year in 2024. Of course, long-range predictions are notoriously difficult. Back in 2001, the FAA said we'd reach the billion mark by 2010. Then came the 9/11 attacks. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You know that great smell of freshly cleaned sheets? Yeah, all that comfort might come with some trade-offs. A peer-reviewed study out from the Silent Spring Institute today finds suspect chemicals in dozens of everyday household products like detergents and cleaners. That part you could probably expect. Except the study found those chemicals even in products that pride themselves on being healthy or environmentally safe. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports now on the challenge of going clean and green at the same time.
It's hard to give customers everything they want in a cleaning product. More people want to avoid chemicals, especially if they have kids or pets, but they still want super strong cleaning power. As a chemistry problem, it boils down to this.
How do you get the function you want without the unwanted characteristics?
James Ewell directs the chemicals program at the nonprofit Green Blue. He says some chemicals are especially tough to avoid, so the goal becomes making them less bad.
Sometimes there are better options within a class of chemicals than others, so you're kind of choosing the best of the worst.
That's why you might see so-called green products show up in studies like this, he says. They have good intentions, but they also have to compromise. Take one type of chemical measured in the study, called phthalates. They help fragrance last longer. And cleaning products that want to be competitive need fragrance, says Maria Bailey with Marketing to Moms.
One of the things that women purchase products based on is the fact that they work. Companies have convinced us that strong odor and a good smell is a sign of clean.
Companies imply a lot about what's in their cleaning products, she says, with words like natural, free, or clear that don't necessarily mean anything. Scott Case at UL Environment says companies need transparency and better labels.
Don't let the consumer decide what's green. Actually look to the experts who have put together definitions and certifications to make it easier.
An ideal certification would not only consider the chemicals in a cleaning product, but also how well it scrubs or scours. I'm Eve Troe from Marketplace.
A year ago this week, Sunday to be precise, a 9.0 earthquake and tsunami hit the northeast coast of Japan. That in turn made the Fukushima Daiichi power plant famous as the site of one of the worst nuclear accidents we've ever known. We're airing a series of stories this week, looking back at what happened and trying to figure out what, if anything, has been learned since then. The stories are being collected in a new public radio series called Burn, an energy journal. And one of the things we're finding out, and that you're going to hear on the first special that airs this weekend, is that in the first couple of days after the earthquake, nobody knew how bad things were. A couple of weeks ago, we had Alex Chadwick with us and some recordings he'd gotten the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to release of its Emergency Response Center. We had the rare chance to hear top government officials trying to manage a dangerous faraway crisis. Here's Alex back now with an update.
For those of you who have just tuned in to NHK World, a major earthquake hit Japan Friday afternoon about an hour ago.
At about the moment of that broadcast on March 11th last year, a tsunami is drowning Fukushima Daiichi. It's late afternoon in Japan, an hour past midnight in Washington, D.C. Before noon, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission activates its Emergency Operations Center, and they hadn't used it since 9/11. The Ops Center records much of what happens. The earlier release of those recordings, first heard on Marketplace, revealed how desperate officials were for information for days. And these newer, more recent releases detail just how disturbing things look as the officials begin to understand.
Most of what we're getting is from press releases from the company TEPCO.
That is Scott Morris. He's deputy director for incident response. Sparse information is how the NRC describes what's coming in.
So I will say that the quantity and quality of information that we're getting is less than we're normally accustomed to, and it's been rather frustrating.
CNN, Wikipedia, YouTube. That is where the U.S. government is getting information on day one, and it's hard to do better. Japan is devastated by the earthquake and the tsunami, a high-tech crisis in the age of information, and there is no information. At least not at the beginning.
Reports from Japan say there's been an explosion at a nuclear power station where there was already an emergency after yesterday's earthquake. A white cloud has been seen rising from the site at the Fukushima No. 1 plant.
On day two, a spark ignites the pressurized atmosphere of hydrogen and steam within the containment building that surrounds reactor unit number one. The next day, the containment building at unit three explodes. That afternoon, the director of U.S. Naval Nuclear Propulsion, Admiral Kirkland Donald, calls into the NRC.
We've detected some activity out at sea on the USS Ronald Reagan that we think you need to be aware of and probably need to be addressing with the Japanese government.
Admiral Donald reports the ship was 100 miles east of Fukushima, that's pretty far away, when it detected the radiation. More explosions at units 2 and 4. And by now, the NRC has people in Tokyo, and they are getting information and calling back.
Unit 4 previously was reported as stable. That is no longer the case. The Unit 4 reactor is defueled. The spent fuel pool is dry, and there appears to be a zirconium fire in the spent fuel pool of Unit 4.
This would have meant a huge release of radiation, but fortunately, that report turned out to be wrong. Still, the situation remains very grave, and they don't know if it's getting worse. NRC Chairman Gregory Yasko.
At this point, I would see the worst scenario probably being three reactors eventually having, for lack of a better term, a meltdown.
Really, a week into the crisis, there's little the NRC can do. This is a global event. The scale of a potential major nuclear meltdown at multiple reactors makes it so. But this is Japan's catastrophe to manage. The executive director for operations at the NRC, Bill Borchardt.
Chairman, this is Bill Borchardt. If this happened in the U.S., we'd go out to 50 miles. That would be our evacuation recommendation.
By Wednesday, March 16th, Japan is ordering an evacuation from all areas within about a dozen miles of Fukushima, 160,000 people. That day, the U.S. ambassador to Tokyo tells Americans to get at least 50 miles away. and the NRC thinks about advising the embassy to order a total American evacuation from all of Japan.
I mean, these people got, it's hell over here for that government. I mean, it's just absolutely hell.
That's Chuck Casto. He's one of the NRC officials sent to Tokyo, and he's calling back in this recording about a week out from the earthquake and tsunami when it's still very hard to know what's happening.
Now, I know we get frustrated with them, but, man, when you think about what they're faced with, it's absolutely unfathomable when you got 1,000 dead bodies washing up on the shore.
The earthquake and tsunami a year ago killed at least 20,000 people and took down the Daiichi nuclear plant because the tsunami knocked out the cooling systems. It and the earthquake also destroyed infrastructure over wide areas, roads, bridges, utility lines, power, and communications. Engineers and technocrats who run agencies like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission make decisions based on data. Here were nuclear reactors melting down, and for a long while, there was no data. Chuck Casto of the NRC.
You know, we think we'd be prepared for it, but it is tough for them. And we're over here barking at them about, and I want to do it, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to, but, you know, we do have to be a little patient. They're working.
That's from the recordings released by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission of its efforts trying to respond to the crisis of the Fukushima meltdown. It happens that the NRC is rebuilding its Emergency Operations Center now. And the lesson from Fukushima, do better with gathering information and try to do better with keeping others informed. Others, that's us, the public. This is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of the new public radio series Burn, an Energy Journal. It's produced by Sound Vision Productions, funded by the National Science Foundation, and distributed by APM. That's this company. The first hour-long broadcasts air this weekend, Nuclear Power After Fukushima.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I just think is kind of a cool story, Forbes magazine is out with its list of female self-made billionaires. It's a pretty small club. Oprah, Meg Whitman, late of eBay, now CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and a woman named Sarah Blakely. She's 41, the youngest woman on the list, sole owner and proprietor of Spanx. It makes girdles, basically. Best part of the whole thing? She got out of college in Florida, thought about law school, didn't go, instead went to Disney World and tried out to be Goofy. They wouldn't hire her because she was too short. And look at her now. I just think that's great. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow picked up 70 points, more than 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 34 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 tagged on 13 points, just shy of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.